Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Our program originates from the friendly confines of KALW, 91.7 Information Radio for San Francisco.
But you notice, John, in our imagination, in our own inner consciousness, we can be anywhere. We can be down in the Philosophy Corner at Stanford.
We can imagine being anywhere we want, and at any time. We can imagine being at Plato's Academy, listening to Plato and Aristotle discuss the good and the true.
In Greek?
Oh, there is that. But there's no denying it's great to be conscious, to see, to feel, to imagine, to think, to experience. Don't you agree, Ken?
Yeah, John, you're going on about all these great things about consciousness, but you really haven't told me what it is. I mean, I have unconscious thoughts and conscious thoughts. What's the difference between being conscious and unconscious?
Well, being conscious isn't the same as having a mind. It's just part of it. I mean, a lot of our thinking and deliberating and so forth is unconscious. It's not present to us. We're not aware of it going on. It's not like anything to do, but a lot of it is. I mean, if you have a pain, if you eat a chocolate chip cookie, it's like something to have those experiences.
Yeah.
Surely, can't even you know the difference between being in pain and tasting a chocolate chip cookie?
I do know the difference between my being in pain and my tasting a chocolate chip cookie. I like the latter and I don't like the former too much. But, you know, I know about me, but you, I don't know about you. I mean, I don't know if there's even anything there at all.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, for all I can really observe, you could have what going on in your consciousness when I step on your toe, what goes on in my consciousness when I eat a chocolate chip cookie, and vice versa. So
yeah.
The nicest thing I could do to you is step on your toe. That's an interesting possibility,
that's
Ken.
That's true, John. You're kind of like that 12-year-old kid. Remember being 12 years old or maybe even 10 and wondering when you look at green and see, there's green. It's something it's like to see green, and wondering if other people saw the same thing as you when you saw green. Maybe they saw red when you saw green.
Ken, I remember being 61 years old and thinking thought. I've been thinking about that since I was 10 or 12, and I never have quite figured it out, although sometimes in my writings I claim to.
Yeah, that's so philosophy begins with 10-year-old worries, and you're still worrying about them when you're 61.
I think that's consciousness. I guess why we have so many listeners. It's all these superannuated 10-year-olds out there.
And consciousness is one of those things.
But how about pain? I mean, pain is something that we must think we know everybody has the same because we worry about it. We're sympathetic with other people in pain. Surgeons don't just cut into you without giving you anesthetic because they assume that what's going on in you would be what would be like what was going on in them.
Yeah, that's a good question. They assume that, but how really do they know it? I mean, that's the real question that we have to get to. How really do you know anything about the contents of another person's conscious experience? I mean, science can't answer that. It can't tell you. It can say, your brain's doing this, but it can't tell you how it feels.
Well, maybe it can. Maybe we're just ignorant philosophers, and if we talk to a kind of a scientist or a medical man or a surgeon, we'd get some of the answers.
Yeah, funny you should say that. Or Amy Standen did just that. A roving philosophical reporter has filed this report about what happens to our consciousness when we go under the knife.
Most people have a sense of what it's like to be conscious, but far fewer of us make a career out of bringing people in and out of it. Stuart Hameroff has practiced anesthesiology for 30 years. He's also the associate director of the Center for Consciousness Studies at the University of Arizona. I asked Hameroff, how can he tell for sure when one of his patients has fully gone under?
We don't absolutely know because we can't directly observe consciousness. I can't say for sure that you are conscious. You could be an android or what philosophers call a zombie. And likewise, you don't know for sure that I'm conscious. We know through indirect methods. We know when the patient lose their eyelid reflex, when the blood pressure settles into a stable level and the heart rate is stable, things like that.
In other words, your anesthesiologist really doesn't know whether you're unconscious or not until the doctor yanks out your appendix and you don't scream out in pain. Even then, it's a mystery. Physicians have been using anesthesia to induce unconsciousness for over a century. But that still doesn't mean they can tell you what consciousness is.
Well, I don't think science can explain consciousness whatsoever at this point. We know how the brain works in a lot of ways, but what we don't know is how the brain produces conscious experience. The fact that we have awareness, an inner life, and perceptions. We could have complex behavior. We could even be having this conversation, perhaps, but neither of us would have any inner experience or inner life or conscious awareness. We could be more or less faking it. That's what robots are designed to do.
One thing we do know about consciousness is that when you lose it, you also lose your perception of time. For Hameroff, that's a clue into how the mind works.
When you go to sleep at night and wake up in the morning, you can usually make a rough guess how long you were asleep. But when you're anesthetized, you don't know if it's 5 seconds, 5 minutes, 5 hours, or 5 days. Time just does not pass. And I think that's because consciousness is a sequence of discrete events, little moments of consciousness. It's like a frame in a movie. You know, people in a car accident, the car is spinning, time slows down. Michael Jordan said that when he's feeling it in basketball, the other team is in slow motion. That's because I think Jordan would be having more conscious events per given time. But when you're anesthetized, you're having none of them, so time doesn't pass at all.
Hameroff believes that humans experience about 40 conscious events, or film stills, per second. Michael Jordan, mid-game, may get more than 40, while your average earthworm, Hameroff thinks, experiences only 3 or 4 a minute. So, since it's the anesthesiologist who's essentially turning off the film projector, what does Hameroff think about as he watches his patients drift off into the mysterious netherworld of unconsciousness?
Well, I'm very compulsive about making sure that all the monitors are working and that the airway is secure and I've got everything I need. It's kind of like flying an airplane. The takeoffs and landings are the most critical, and it's normally routine, but, you know, every once in a while you have a crisis, and so you've got to anticipate things. But after things are going well, I'm still amazed, even after 30 years of doing it, that, you know, the consciousness goes away. It makes me wonder where they go, but more importantly, why we're conscious in the first place.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks for that report, Amy. You know, John, one of my favorite stories about anesthesiology goes back to the turn of the 20th century. They used to think curare was an anesthetic. Now, curare, what it does is it paralyzes you completely. And patients would go under curare. They'd be completely immobilized. So they didn't have any behavior, right, that exhibited consciousness. But they would wake up after the surgery was over and say, "It hurt like heck, and I just couldn't say anything." And the physicians did not believe them. They didn't believe them until a physician himself went under the knife, under curare, and woke up and said, "My God, it hurt like heck, but I couldn't say anything." So, you know, well, it took a while to get to this.
That's pretty terrifying, Ken. I wonder if some of today's HMOs and insurance companies will want to go back to curare use a memory blocker to stop the complaint. But I guess we've come a long ways from Carrara, or even before that, from like in the old Western movies, you take a shot of booze and you bite a bullet. I've never bitten a bullet, but I do enjoy a glass of whiskey, but I certainly wouldn't want to rely on that if I was going to undergo some surgery.
Well, John, I can't help you with the whiskey part, but why don't we elevate this conversation a bit? And here to add a new voice is Professor David Chalmers of the University of Arizona, coming to us from station KUAT. Professor Chalmers is the author of the book, The Conscious Mind, In Search of a Fundamental Theory. I hope he's found it out there somewhere. He is also director of the Center for Consciousness Studies. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David.
Hey there, philosophy guys.
Hi, David. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Now, I've got a question for you. You wrote this book, The Conscious Mind. You're director of the Center for Consciousness Studies. You wouldn't do all that if you thought you were the only conscious person in the world. So can you help us with the problem of other minds? When I talk to you, you seem to be a person with one of the most lively consciousnesses I've ever encountered. What? How do I really know that there's anything going on behind those lively eyes? Or how do you know there's anything going on behind my languid brown ones?
Well, number one datum is the first person datum, right? I know I'm conscious, and I take it you know you're conscious. At least I hope you know you're conscious.
Well,
the tricky part...
You assume it and you hope it, but do you really know it?
The tricky part is the extension, right? How do I know there's anything going on with you? The time-honored way for knowing this is basically to assume it based on indirect evidence. You're like me in a lot of respects. You got a brain like mine, kind of. You got a behavior like mine. You got evolutionary history like mine. We got so much in common. Why wouldn't you be conscious too? Furthermore, you tell me you're conscious. You give me verbal reports of consciousness. I take all that to be good indirect evidence that you're conscious. Does it prove you're conscious? Absolutely not.
Suppose there was a parking lot with 1,000 cars in it, and I opened the front door of one car, and there was a box of Kleenex on the seat. And I infer from that one case that all the others, there'll be a box of Kleenex on the seat. That's a pretty weak inference. And you essentially saying we have to go from one case, our own case, to nowadays 6 billion others. Isn't that a pretty risky inference?
Yeah, there's an element of risk there. What we do have that we don't have in the case of the box of Kleenex is an element of systematicity. I know from my own case that my consciousness goes along systematically with, you know, changes in my consciousness, go along with changes in my behavior. I close my eyes, I change my consciousness. You affect my brain with alcohol, my consciousness changes in some pretty weird ways. So it's connected pretty systematically to the brain, to behavior, and I take it to my history.
Let me ask you a question, David. Suppose that I knew everything there was to know about your brain. Let's think about whether there could be direct evidence, I guess, maybe. I don't know. I knew everything there was about your brain. I knew what states of arousal you were in. I know what was going on in this or that section. Right? I look at David Chalmers and said, here's his cerebroscope printout. Of course he's conscious because he's got brain activity thus and thus here and so and so there. I mean, couldn't I do it
Do I really want to know about David's states of arousal, Ken? I mean,
yeah, well,
can we just kind of say what colors is he looking at? And
yeah, well,
like
you
that?
Know what I mean. States of conscious awareness. Couldn't I just have a brain graph to prove that you were conscious?
Well, we're moving in that direction. Now we have brain scans where you can scan the different areas of my brain and see what's lighting up. But still the step to consciousness is a bit of a leap of faith, or at least an inference. You know, what the holy grail in this field, what people really want is the consciousness meter, the thing that I point at your brain and it gives me a direct readout of Ken Taylor's consciousness, you know, warts and all, what he's seeing, what he's thinking, what he's feeling, what he's, harboring merely a secret fantasy in the background of his mind. But we don't have a consciousness meter. There's simply no way to mainline another person's consciousness directly.
Is that because there couldn't be one? I mean, you said there's an element of risk. I'm trying to feel, why is it so risky? Why can't I just look in the brain, know enough about the brain, and have a decisive answer? David Chalmers is not a zombie. I mean, what's the element of risk? I don't see it yet.
What do you mean by a zombie there, Ken?
A thing that looks like it's conscious, acts like it's conscious, talks like it's conscious, but is just a fake.
Now, that's a little bit of a philosophical work of art. A zombie is just a dead body that's come back to life and walks funny. So
yeah, but that's,
just let our audience,
yeah,
this is
right.
The way
philosophers use zombie.
Well, following David Chalmers,
yeah.
One of the innovators in this field, that's the way we use the word zombie.
So make me feel this risk. I don't feel it yet. Vividly.
Okay, yeah. So these aren't Dawn of the Dead zombies. Dawn of the Dead zombies are pretty behaviorally different from normal people, and they probably even have some conscious experiences. Philosopher zombies, on the other hand, they're beings that wander around walking and talking just like normal people, have no consciousness at all. Everything is completely dark.
They populate
inside
philosophy departments a lot. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I've had suspicions about a few of my professional colleagues.
But anyway, make me feel this gap you're talking about.
The question, nobody actually thinks that a zombie exists. I mean, we hope fervently that no zombies actually exist. The question, though, is how do you know for sure? When I'm talking to you, I see your behavior. I could maybe even measure your brain in principle. But there's no contradiction in supposing that you completely lack consciousness. I mean, we're getting computers that are more and more sophisticated all the time, that can fake it in conversation, come up with good responses, make their way around the world, and so on. And most people believe those computers, despite all the intelligent things they can do, playing a game of chess and so on, lack anything in the way of first-person conscious experience.
We're talking with David Chalmers on Philosophy Talk. Is consciousness just a process in the brain? I know I'm conscious from the inside, but I don't have any direct access to your inside. So how can I know that you are conscious? There are robots and zombies that fake consciousness. How about you? Are you faking it?
We'd like you to join in. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment.
Philosophy will return after this.
My heart all full of pain. I would dance and be merry, life would be a ding-a-dairy if I only had a brain.
Ray Bolger as the Scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, but this week we are questioning your consciousness. I'm Ken Taylor. Joining us from Tucson is Professor David Chalmers of the University of Arizona.
Our topic today is, what is consciousness? We'd like to hear what's on your conscious mind. As a matter of fact, why don't you call in and prove to us that you're conscious?
You can do that at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. So, David, you were trying to make me feel this gap before the break, and I get the idea that you think, well, we could know everything there is to know about the brain, but we could still have a question. Is she conscious? Is it conscious? I mean, that nothing we know about the brain could settle that question for us. Is that kind of how you were trying to make me feel that gap?
A lot is coming out of the science these days. I mean, in the last 10 or 20 years, there's been a big progress on the science of consciousness in a way there wasn't before. We can find the areas of the brain that seem to light up and get active when you're conscious, the areas of the brain that, you know, correlate most especially with a pain or with a visual experience. But what we're getting out of this is what you might call a science of correlation. When this happens in your brain, this is what you feel in your consciousness. When this happens in your consciousness, this is what goes on in the brain. What we're lacking is a sense of explanation. Why is it that when all these neurons come together in this area of the brain, it feels like something for the subject of the experience? That is what some philosophers have called an explanatory gap.
Yeah.
There's just a leap there that we haven't yet got to the bottom of.
David, I want to go back to my example of the parking lot full of cars. And you've convinced me that finding other people as conscious isn't like finding a Kleenex box on the front seat. It seems to me it's more like raising the hood and finding the engine. That is, we find something that's essential for the car to work the way it is. And then even in one case, we can infer, well, all these other cars must have something like that. Now, is this your picture of consciousness, that it's this essential thing like the engine in a car that has some essential work to do, and so we see its effects and we know it must be there?
That's absolutely the intuitive picture of consciousness. When we do something, when I talk, when I walk, it feels like it's my consciousness that's doing the deciding and the acting. But the more and more we know about the brain, and the more that comes out of the sciences, the more it turns out we can explain a whole bunch of the things we do in terms of dumb processes in the brain without ever once bringing consciousness into the picture. This is all stuff that a robot could do.
Isn't that kind of frightening? I mean, I want my consciousness to play a role in my life.
This is what we all hope. You know, this is one of the things that the scientists and philosophers in this field are searching for, the function of consciousness. That's one of the holy grails. What does it do? But the fact is, right now, nobody has a clue. That's kind of scary.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. So you're suggesting that, I mean, to use a fancy philosophical term, that consciousness might just be epiphenomenal. It might just be up there floating above the fray, but not really doing any work, not really turning any wheels.
Like the foam on the beer.
Yeah, like the foam on the beer. Are you suggesting that?
I think it's a possibility we have to take seriously. Some scientists even, Dan Wegner, a psychologist working on some of this stuff, wrote a book called The Illusion of Conscious Will. He's got a bunch of experiments that suggest, you know, when you feel like you're controlling your action, at least a lot of the time, you're not in control at all. Your action is going by what happens irrespective of your conscious will. Now, I don't know if that applies all the time, but it's led him and some other people at least to speculate that, you know, consciousness isn't really in charge. Rather, it's just the byproduct of the brain processes, and it's the brain that's really in charge.
David, we've got some callers on the line who want to answer our challenge and prove to us that they're conscious. First is Glenn in Marin County. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Glenn.
Well, I don't know how much consciousness I'll claim for myself, but I want to ask about the aspects of consciousness, because it seems to me that a lot of consciousness studies really focus on words and pictures, sorts of conscious aspects as opposed to affective. And like if I'm talking with somebody, it isn't just their words or even just what I see in terms of their body language, but it's actually empathic experiences that I have that I can feel. Even if I'm speaking to them on the phone and they're silent, I can feel that something has shifted. Oh, they've lost interest. Oh, that's upset them. And if I, you know, sort of check in with them, I get enough verification for me to trust this. And, you know, are we looking at affective aspects of consciousness as well? And are we looking at extracerebral circuitry? You know, the complex neural networks have been found in the lining of the gut and the tissues of the heart and then sort of the combination of endocrine glands and the way that neurohormones are created outside of the brain and actually circulate in the fluids of the body in sort of a parasynaptic.
Well, you've left us a lot to digest there, speaking of hormones and stuff. David, you got any response? There's lots of questions there. Is there anything in particular you want to pick up on?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people now are studying the affective and emotional aspects of consciousness. But the caller, I think, makes a really important point, which is that a lot of the time, at least seems to us, that through empathy, we feel another person's consciousness directly. It's not like we need to make a big inference. It's we sense what's going on in another person's mind. And you might think, some people have suggested, that empathy is a route to finding out what's going on in another person's consciousness. But at the same time, there's a slightly scary fact that, you know, for example, researchers in robotics have come up with artificial intelligence creatures that come up with just the right facial expressions that stimulate us in just the right way to feel sorry for them or sympathetic with them. And then we feel exactly that same empathy for a robot. We feel like we're mainlining, oh my God, that poor creature, it's so sad, it's happy, whatever. And we feel like we're mainlining a robot's consciousness through empathy when I guess most of us believe there's no consciousness there at all.
We're talking to David Chalmers. This is Philosophy Talk. Our next caller is Romer in San Francisco. Hi, Romer.
And then dial your operator.
Hey, I guess we lost Romer.
There is Romer. Romer, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, go.
Excellent show, by the way, and I'm particularly fond of your guest. And
Thank you.
It struck me enough to pull over and want to call, so here I am. I would like to talk about something that I find very obvious going through my normal day, and that is that there is an obvious consciousness that exists in all people, but that level of consciousness does not remain the same from person to person. On any given day, I can encounter people that are barely conscious of their surroundings and people who are hyper-conscious.
Okay, so you're thinking about, thanks for the call, Romer, you're thinking about different levels of consciousness and our awareness of these different levels
this
of consciousness.
This is consciousness of things he seems to be talking about, consciousness of people and things around you. And he's certainly right, there's a big difference. There's some people you encounter that are very unconscious or lack consciousness of, like, that their body is in the way of anybody who wants to go through the door, and other people are very sensitive to those things. What do you think about that, David?
Well, it does bring out the point that consciousness is not an on-off meter. It's not just this light that comes on and comes off. It comes in degrees, and also, more importantly, it's multi-track. It's like this incredible movie inside our minds, but it doesn't just have, you know, sound, audio, and video, but has feelings, emotions, thoughts. So consciousness can have a whole lot in it at certain times. And, you know, as we wake up in the morning or as we go to sleep, it can fade out to almost nothing. So these tracks come in, they fade out. We get very intense in certain moments. And then, of course, at moments of great alertness, and there's an incredible degree of focus and content to our consciousness.
David, I want to go back to something that you said in response to Glenn, I think it was. That seemed to me actually a profound point that we should maybe focus on a little bit more. You, in talking about empathy, maybe human beings just have a way of knowing the minds of other human beings that is different from, you know, scientific investigation. Science, you say, here's all that's going on in the brain, and it still leaves open the question. But I have this sense that I'm in kind of community with another human being. I'm aware that they're aware. I'm conscious that they're conscious as a kind of fundamental thing that's not reducible to other ways of knowing people. Maybe there's just a special way we have of knowing not just our own minds, but other people's minds. What do you think about that?
I think science is bringing out that we do have certain kinds of special social senses when we interact with other people that leads us to have a sense of what's going on in other people's minds. It isn't just a big scientific inference. And it's natural to see why evolution might have programmed that into us. You know, we want to believe that our mates love us, and that our children are having certain kinds of feelings, and we've got to feel bad when they're in pain. Still, the question is that a way of forming beliefs about another person's mind, or is it a way of knowing what's in their mind? And a little bit of doubt about the second comes when you start looking at these experiments on robots and other systems where we feel all this empathy, even though nothing's going on at all.
David, a minute ago, you said you were at least willing to flirt with the idea of epiphenomenalism. Now, I would find it pretty depressing if my decisions and intentions didn't really affect my actions. But it wouldn't be the end of the world. I would be at least grateful that I had the sensation of eating chocolate chip cookies and at least the pleasurable parts of consciousness. But I would be stumped to explain why that evolved. If it doesn't cause anything, what function could it have? And if it doesn't have a function, why would it be there?
Well, some people, including me, have been led to speculate that consciousness is actually, you know, a truly basic component of the universe. And, you know, basic components of the universe like matter and space and time aren't things that need to evolve. They're things that are just kind of basic in the laws of nature. And, you know, if it turns out that there's no way to explain consciousness wholly in terms of interactions among bits of matter, I think we're basically led to the conclusion that what we have here is an extra fundamental element of nature. There's mass, there's charge, there's space, yeah. And there's consciousness.
David,
if so, then
David, you're a not-so-old-fashioned dualist. We have some callers on the line. Let's see if what they think about your dualism, David. Paul in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hi, Neil. Two comments. One, in terms of the state of science and the ability of things like PET scans to measure brain activity, I was sort of taken with a comment that a neuroscientist made recently in a book whose title I forget, that when they did comparisons between active thinking, creative thinking, and other forms of thought, that the most quiet part of the quiet activity of the brain was when it was at its most creative, and conversely, when the individual was struggling, trying to come up with ideas or frustration, that was when the brain seemed to have its greatest metabolic activity, which seems to suggest that consciousness might not be necessarily correlated with activity in the brain. However, the main point I wanted to make is that on the assumption that one of the people just made, that consciousness is a fundamental part of brain activity related to the ability to recognize time, some form of time, and really is a fundamental part of organic nature, that instead of looking at the uniqueness of human beings as being conscious and trying to study what it is in human beings, facial expressions, etc., that make up consciousness, we should be looking at the comparative consciousness of other species, of trying to understand what it is in their own forms of intelligence and ability to recognize, not necessarily empathize, but recognize emotions and actions of ourselves, of looking at what it is that represents consciousness in other individuals, because consciousness seems to be focused on it being a unique human trait.
Paul, you make some good points. I mean, but David, I want to turn Paul's comments into a question for you. I mean, look, studying human consciousness is hard enough. Can we be at all confident that animals, non-human animals, have consciousness? Are there any that you say, aha, there's consciousness for you?
Most of us want to believe that animals are consciousness, but here that paradox you talked about earlier, the problem of other minds, really strikes us with a vengeance, because at least with other human beings, the single best sign we have of consciousness is language and verbal report. How do I know you're conscious? Well, you tell me you are. That's not proof, but it's pretty good reason. Animals don't have language. They don't give us reports, so the reasons for doubt just come back tenfold. Still, a lot of people think there's at least indirect evidence that monkeys, dogs, and so on have some kind of consciousness. Monkeys, it seems, can recognize themselves in the mirror, for example. Some people suggest this is a certain representation of self. You put something on their forehead, they look in the mirror, they'll wipe it off their forehead. That suggests the monkey at least has some sense of who it is. Could it do all that in the absence of consciousness? Well, you know, maybe. But at least this is maybe some indirect reason for thinking there's something vicinity going on.
I must admit, David, if I'm willing to give Ken consciousness, I guess I'm not that impressed with language, but if I'm willing to give Ken consciousness, I'd certainly give it to a lot of animals. I don't know how far low I'd go.
Are you saying that animals, I'm not going, I don't know, John.
No, I mean, same with me. I mean, language isn't that impressive. My computer can speak to me, but when Ken feels pain, when Ken feels joy, I see expressions there that are just very hard to interpret any other way. So these people that deny consciousness to dogs and so forth, I don't have much sympathy for them. But I want to ask you a question, David. On this theory you presented a little while ago that sounds intriguing to me, that consciousness is kind of a fundamental part of the world system, we would expect to see a lot of signs of it outside of humans, wouldn't we? Because, I mean, it's a part of everything. How would we look for it? How would we verify that kind of radical theory you put forward?
Yeah, let me add on there. I mean, most fundamental stuff, you know, fundamental particles, fundamental qualities are all over the place. You know, they're just all over the place. Consciousness, especially at your last remark, seems to hide only in human brains, a small corner of the universe. How could something that fundamental hide in such a small corner of the universe, David?
Well, I think maybe there's some reasons to doubt that consciousness does hide just in this small corner of the universe. That's to say, if consciousness is fundamental, it may be a lot more widespread than we think. A moment ago, we said, you know, we don't know about dogs or cats or whatever, that they're conscious for sure. But the flip side of that is we don't know that they're not. You know, we can look in even pretty simple systems like bacteria, viruses, and so on. Okay, we don't think they're conscious, but we don't know that we're not. I mean, the problem kind of comes down to this problem of measurement. If we had that consciousness meter that we could point at things and just get a readout of their consciousness, then we'd know. But we don't know. So we're left with these indirect inferences. But quite a few great philosophers have been led to speculate that consciousness goes very deep in the natural order.
Well, that's certainly true. We have a whole lineup of callers. The phones are just ringing off the hooks, David. And I'm going to give some folks a chance to talk to you before we run out of time here. Alex in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alex.
Hello. I don't understand why or exactly what you mean by direct connection to another mind, since we don't have any. How do you know what it is? It sounds to me almost like revelation. I don't see why direct, if you have it, how would I know you have it with some other mind, unless I have it with you? Who would believe me if I said I did? It seems to me indirect inference is really far more reliable. Direct sounds almost religious to me.
Alex, you're making a challenging point here, and I'm going to give David Chalmers a chance to take up that point after our next break. But we're talking with David Chalmers of the University of Arizona, trying to wrap our minds around what makes us conscious beings. Up next, though, is Ian Shows, the 60-second philosopher. He'll enlighten us about one of the firm believers in the irreducibility of consciousness. That was Rene Descartes. You're listening to Philosophy Talk.
Jimi Hendrix asking the musical question, are you experienced? You know, whether experience is just an aspect of the brain or something the brain causes, whether experience is epiphenomenal or part of the causal order, it is great stuff. I'm so glad that I have experience, and I'm glad that you do too. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This week, we're not questioning your intelligence, but we are questioning your consciousness.
Now, one of the founders of consciousness studies historically would have been Rene Descartes, and I think Rene and our guest David Chalmers would have hit it off pretty good, because they both think that consciousness is fundamental, irreducible to the physical, fascinating, and important. Our 60-second philosopher, Ian Scholes, will give us some background on the great thinker Rene Descartes.
Ian Scholes, Rene Descartes was born in a French village in 1596 and attended a Jesuit college where he excelled in mathematics. Later, he took a degree in law, which he never practiced, and served in the Dutch and Bavarian militaries. He achieved a great deal of fame in his time as philosopher, mathematician, a dandy, and a swordsman. In 1649, Descartes was summoned by the teenaged Queen Christina of Sweden to tutor her in philosophy. On arrival, he found that she wanted her lessons at 5 a.m. every morning. Unused to the cold and the early hours, he liked to stay in bed till noon. Descartes caught pneumonia and died in Stockholm on February 11th, 1650. He was 54. He had spent the previous 20 years in semi-seclusion in Holland, thinking thoughts that make most people dizzy, asking himself, what do I know, and what does the knowing? For all he knew, life could be a dream. Reality could be a construct, kind of like the Matrix, foisted on him by an evil demon. He thinks he knows that a table has four legs, but how can he be absolutely sure? As Groucho Marx put it later, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? The only thing Descartes could be certain of was that there was a self that doubted his own eyes, hence his famous syllogism, I think, therefore I am. So his first self-evident truth was that of the self. The second was the existence of God. He finally concluded, quote, "By God, I understand a substance which is infinite, independent, supremely intelligent, supremely powerful, and which created both myself and everything else, if else there be, that exists. All these attributes are such that, the more carefully I concentrate on them, the less possible it seems that they could have originated from me alone. So, from what has been said, it must be concluded that God necessarily exists." In other words, the self experiences the idea of the perfect being. The self, being less than perfect, could not have invented the idea of a perfect being. Therefore, the perfect being must exist. And would a perfect being deceive us? No. Therefore, the physical world also exists, because God willed it. And so the physical world dodged a bullet, thanks to René Descartes. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher. Today, Ian put Descartes before the public. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Professor David Chalmers of the University of Arizona, where he's a professor of philosophy and director of the Center for Consciousness Studies. David, let's take up Descartes for a minute. He's one of the world's great dead dualists. You're one of the world's great living dualists. Now, Descartes, had lots of reasons for being a dualist. He didn't think anything like human thought, human language, human rationality could be put in anything that was merely mechanical, a mere body. He kind of worried about consciousness, too. But I think if he was living today, the rationality, the thought, the language, he'd have to concede that the computer revolution and AI was making great strides, and I bet he wouldn't be so confident. Why is consciousness any harder than the rest of that stuff? Why won't we someday, refute your dualism and show that consciousness isn't fundamental and machines can have it and all that stuff? Why are you so confident it's fundamental?
Well, Descartes was a great naturalist, so I think he would have loved what's going on right now in the sciences. But still, I think he would have had the feeling that it wasn't getting to the heart of the matter. What have we got out of the last few decades of neuroscience, psychology, and so on? Really nice explanations of aspects of behavior, especially aspects of language, perceptual discrimination, motor response, and so on. But in some sense, these are what you might call the easy problems of the mind. It's just explaining how we do things, how we respond to inputs, how we produce outputs in a particularly systematic and smart way. The basic question which worried Descartes was, why is there a first-person perspective here? Why is there a self? Why is there a subject of experience? And it seems to me that, for everything we've got out of the computer revolution and philosophy, it hasn't really gone to the heart of that question. We can picture a computer doing all that stuff without any subjective experience at all.
Well, David, I have a question for you. Ken says you're a dualist, but from your last theory, it's not so obvious to me that you are a dualist. I mean, materialism is a theory that says there are little particles of matter that have size and extension and shape. But physicists aren't materialists anymore. They believe in quarks with mysterious properties like spin. Now, if consciousness is a fundamental property of the universe, why can't it just be one more of the fundamental properties that we think of as physical? And you could be a monist.
I think there's something to what you say. I don't always describe myself as a dualist. My basic view is consciousness is fundamental and irreducible. If you want to say it's one more physical property, space, time, mass, spin, and consciousness, I don't care how you use the word physical. In fact, I kind of like the idea that somewhere deep in the physical causal order, Immanuel Kant, Bertrand Russell said, we don't know the intrinsic nature of the physical world. The intrinsic nature of the physical world is just revealed to us from the outside, from how it looks, from how every physical particle affects every other physical particle. But what's it like in itself? What's the thing in itself? Kant said. One natural speculation is that intrinsic nature of the physical world has something very deep to do with consciousness. This leads to what philosophers call panpsychism.
Yeah, David.
Consciousness.
Right. Panpsychism. Yeah. But again, we're worried about, how pervasive is this fundamental thing. But I think I should take you back to Alex's question. I promised to get you to answer it before we went to the break. He was wondering, isn't it mysterious? You didn't say this. I said this, so maybe I should answer it. I don't know. Isn't it mysterious, the idea that we could somehow have direct access to another person's mind, that we could somehow be built to recognize another conscious being as a conscious being? You kind of responded positively to that suggestion, but Alex thought it was way off. What do you think?
We had been saying that, hey, we don't have direct access to another person's consciousness. If we did, things would be a lot easier. Alex made the excellent point that even if we did, we were in the situation of what we thought was direct access, all the same problems would arise. Just say, I take myself to be feeling your consciousness directly. Well, how do I know That's just another part of my consciousness. Maybe you're just a zombie and I just think I have direct access to you. So his point was that, you know, even direct access wouldn't really help with this problem. Even if we come up with a consciousness meter, it's going to be just another indirect measure. And I think he's absolutely right about that.
Yeah, so, David, let's take another caller. John in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hi, thanks. I was thinking that as you were talking that the concept of consciousness is really a cultural thing, and that I think eventually we won't even use that anymore. Maybe it's like ether used to be. I think that it doesn't add anything to what we know about another human being, whether that person is conscious or not. I think we determine whether that person is another person by sharing experiences. Maybe we both saw a movie at different times and we can talk about it, or we watched them touch something hot and they pull their hand away, and we just observe their behavior. And saying that they're conscious doesn't add anything to that. And I think that this is eventually we will just dismiss this concept as a meaningless concept.
Thank you, John. John's saying we might as well all be zombies, David. Maybe we are all zombies.
I don't think that's quite what he was saying, Ken.
But consciousness, he's what philosophy is another fancy term, eliminativist about consciousness. There really is no such thing, and we'd be better off not talking about it. What do you think about that?
Well, maybe the word consciousness is a cultural construction, like just about any word is, but that the phenomenon is a cultural construction is very hard to believe. I mean, you burn my hand over that hot stove so I'm feeling an intense pain, and then you go tell me that pain I'm feeling is a cultural construction? You know, I know what I'm going to tell you to do.
Pretty hard
to think, to accept there's not something very, very real going on there, as real as anything we know.
Not only, David, is it real, it's deep. I think it's about the deepest fact about human beings, that they are conscious, self-aware, feeling, experiencing beings. It's one of the things that separates us from, you know, all sorts of other things, I think.
Well, I have some sympathy with what the listener said, but there's a difference between the general concept of consciousness and all the particular forms of it we attribute to people. Desires, beliefs, experiences, pains. I just don't think we'll ever do without those concepts. David, it's been a lot of fun talking to you.
David Chalmers is the professor of philosophy at the University of Arizona. He's author of the really great book, The Conscious Mind in Search of a Fundamental Theory. Thank you for joining us on Philosophy Talk, David Chalmers.
Thanks. It's been a good time.
So, John, what wisdom do you have for us today? I mean, have you learned something? Have we taught you something? I know that you and David are at odds about these things.
In print,
they argue back and forth about this stuff.
Yes. Well, David's a very bright, as I like to think of him, young man. I'm sure as he gets older, he'll pay proper attention to my deep insights. But actually, he's written this great book that has gotten a lot of people interested in consciousness. He's put this intuitions for dualism about as effectively as they can be put. But I think as he's drifting into this panpsychist theory, it really is going to turn out to be a form of physicalism. It may be quite plausible. You never know. Yeah. I'll probably never know. Maybe you and he'll live long enough to know.
I don't think panpsychism has. My own view is consciousness is good and something special about human beings, and it's not everywhere. I mean, that's the cool thing about it. It's not everywhere. If it's a fundamental, it would be matter is electrons are everywhere. Consciousness just hides in very special brains.
Well, Berkeley would say, have you ever seen anything without consciousness?
Well, that's true. But
no,
that's
every time
program.
You see something, you're conscious.
Well, that's right. But consciousness goes where I go, where minds go. But minds aren't everywhere. Electrons don't have any minds.
Do we really have any record of any observation of anything that didn't involve consciousness? Because the observation was conscious.
You're getting spooky on me. I think we got to end this conversation before I get really weirded out by you, John.
Okay, Ken.
Is behind. Come with us and find the pleasures of the journey to the center of the mind. Take the time to journey to the center of the mind. Center of the mind.
thunder? Or is that drumming?
It's not drumming, Ken. It's conundrumming.
What's a conundrum?
A conundrum is a problem, an intellectual problem, or even an ethical problem that one of our listeners has and shares with us.
We have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Chuck.
Hi there.
Where are you from, Chuck?
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. We get a lot of callers from Portland. It's a beautiful place. How's the rain?
Today, the weather has been wonderful.
Wonderful means overcast and just a little bit of rain?
That's what we tell the people from California.
Yeah, they want to keep us out.
That's right.
So, Chuck, what's your conundrum?
My conundrum is, what should my attitude be about good things from bad people?
Hmm.
I like classical music, and in particular, I like the music of Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
But Wagner himself was an anti-Semite and had many other features that were not very good.
Well, but Wagner's dead, right?
Well, Wagner is dead, and I think that's one of the factors.
Well, let's see. Wagner is dead, but his music is, for a while at any rate, it was banned in Israel.
Yes.
Probably not so much because he was an anti-Semite as because he was an important person and an anti-Semite and was admired by so many anti-Semites in the 20th century that really were terrible. So it's sort of a symbolic act. It's not like Wagner's still getting royalties.
Correct.
I mean, what bad thing are you doing if you listen to Wagner? You're not endorsing his anti-Semitism, are you, by listening to his music?
I don't know. I would like to think I'm not, but a related problem might be you might like the movies that a movie star makes, mm-hmm. but you might not like that movie star's politics. So should you go to those movies or should you not? You know, a lot of people were very unhappy with Jane Fonda during the Vietnam era.
Yeah, but I mean, would you not employ somebody whose politics you detested?
Oh, I certainly would. I would hope that wouldn't have any effect.
Would you not buy a meal from a restaurant where you detested the politics of the chef?
Well, that one's a little bit tougher. What if you went to a restaurant, it was a wonderful restaurant, and then you found out that it was used to promote neo-Nazis.
Oh, well, then you shouldn't go there. I think there are clear cases in which you shouldn't do the thing. You shouldn't consume the product or visit the movies or go to the restaurant or whatever. Because if somebody's going to use the profits that they make out of this running this restaurant to go out and advocate for neo-Nazi causes, well, then you're contributing to that.
From my kind of, simple-minded, utilitarian, until proven innocent basis, the first question would be, say, I really like this movie, or I really like this Wagnerian opera. Now, if I don't listen to it, the one clear effect is I'm deprived of something I like. So what good is going to come from this? Unless I had a clear answer to that question, and I might. It might be that I enjoy, George's weekly hash special at the corner, but I know that the profits from it go to the Ku Klux Klan, then I'm not going to go there. But unless I have a pretty clear answer to that, based not on hypotheticals but on the actual situation, I'd say enjoy and just get your mind off the bad features of the person who created it.
Chuck, I hope we've helped a little bit.
Yes. Actually, this idea of asking yourself what good or what bad will come from the action, I think, is a very good guideline.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
If you've been struggling with a moral question, a dilemma, a puzzle, we'd like to help.
We can't guarantee the quality of our advice, but we'll guarantee it comes from nice guys who are trying hard. Send your conundrum to conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Or go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and click on that button at the top right-hand corner. Don't forget to let us know where we can reach you so that you can join our program. Once again, that's conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and members of KALW, Information Radio 91.7, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders or of any other conscious being.
However, no one is precluded from adopting the views expressed on this show, so think about that sometimes. The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org.
I'm Ken Taylor. Go to our webpage and click on the forums button and join our ever-growing community of online thinkers. Thank you for listening.
And I'm John Perry. Thank you for thinking.